Here we go. This is Friday, January 17th, 2014, I believe. It is a snowy, cold, but beautiful day here in Louisville, Kentucky. We're on the fourth floor of the Ekstrom Library, and we're recording an oral history of WHAS. I have with me Jerry David Malloy. Jerry, say hi to everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Jerry, we've already recorded Jerry, and famous morning man, Wayne Perkey.
You'll hear from my mother.
And we are pleased to be talking not here in cold, snowy Louisville, but I hope sunny and warm San Antonio, Texas, a person who had a strong influence on WHAS. Highly respected and highly successful radio career, Hugh Barr. Hi, Hugh. How are you today?
Hey, I am doing great. I am so delighted to be with you guys. And yes, it is sunny. You know, I finally settled in San Antonio by choice. And after coming down here from Syracuse, where the skies were gray and cloudy, and every day I was I'd get up here and the skies are blue, and like right now it's blue and 70 degrees. And
oh my goodness.
It's just, you know, it's lovely. I can run out, get the newspaper and, you know, and a t-shirt.
Well, if we'd had the budget, we would be doing this there on the Riverwalk, I'll tell you. So. Hey, Hugh, you know, we're going to talk about how you got connected with HAS and your time there, but I want to talk a little bit about how it led up to that. But also, I was searching the internet, and I ran across a YouTube video of some guys who also hold you in high respect. Evidently, when you left or resigned or retired from Cox Radio there in San Antonio as president and general manager, there was a group of people called themselves the Coxmen from Cox Radio, and they did a series of tribute songs called the Hugh Songs. And they were, "We love Hugh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll still love Hugh tomorrow, and that's what I like about Hugh." And so those kind of things were, that was obviously evident throughout your career, because the guys here, if we'd been ingenious enough and talented enough, we would have done the same thing. But tell us about how you, where are you originally from? Where was home for you?
Actually, home was, my dad was chair of the math department at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, a small little town. And by virtue of coming up through an academic family, my first thought was going into school. I was going to, I started in pre-law. I didn't know whether I'd do that or be a doctor or, you know, kind of the usual traditional something or other. And got involved in doing a little drama and doing some speech. And in those days, anything having to do with communications basically was under the speech department umbrella. And that wooed me into that side of the biz. And I spent a couple of years there at the University of Wyoming, and the last couple of years at the University of Miami in Florida. And so I never could really go back and adjust to Laramie again after.
I'm sure that's true. Now, what year? What years was this? Just for our historical purpose, these were what years, Hugh?
You're sure this is not for some Purians?
Oh man, within inches of a clean getaway. I thought I had it there.
I graduated in 57.
Okay.
Which shocks me when I say the number. It just seems so unreal.
But believe me, we all understand here.
In those days, nobody at the university level was doing much in radio TV. There were a few schools, UCLA, Northwestern, CCNY, and the University of Miami. But the other schools were all doing at graduate level the stuff that I wanted, and Miami had it available as an undergrad course. So basically, that's how I wind up in Miami. No great magic to it. Did the usual routine following school. Did a little part-time back in my old hometown.
Were you announcing? Were you announcing or a program director?
At this point, I was a young and struggling jock who thought I was going to be the most spectacular jock in the world, of course. And so that was a little town called in Laramie, a little station called KOWB Cowboy Radio. Actually, it was owned by Kurt Gowdy, a name you guys remember.
It was sportscaster?
Yes, yes. And after that, I, of course, had a little tour in the service, and Left that in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Worked at a radio TV outfit there for a little while. Somebody thought I should come back to Wyoming, and which I did. Came up to Casper, Wyoming for, I think a couple of years, and then somebody thought maybe I should join him over in the Salt Lake City market, actually little town Ogden. At that point, it was a big station. It was a KLO. I mean, a three-letter call letter was pretty exciting to me as a kid in those days.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they had gone a little nuts and gave me the PD hat. So I had been PD for several years, and knew it was time, frankly, to be leaving where I was. And somebody clued me that the fathership there, the mother load in Louisville, was looking for a program director. So I started a process of communication. You guys may remember the name George Walsh.
Sure.
Yes.
Who actually, it was the guy I communicated with. This went on for some time with tons of tapes, and as I found out later, they did a full personal investigation of me, talked to all my neighbors. I mean, it was a national security background check.
This was the Bingham. And the Bingham still owned it then, didn't they? The Binghams were involved, yeah.
Yes, and Vic Scholl was another name you guys may remember.
Yes.
Was actually running the joint at that point. And I came down, and we had a nice day together and talked and chatted. And about 2 months later, after some intervening communication, I got a phone call and came down to WHAS and as program director, and I just was elated, of course.
What year was that, you recall what year that was?
That would have been...
68.
I'm going to say, yeah, 67 or 68 in there.
Okay. Were they still operating in the Courier Journal building, or were they in the new building at that time?
No, they had just moved into the new building. It was less than a year old, as I recall. I thought it was a Valhalla place, of course. It really was. I mean, pretty outstanding facility. And, that was great. In fact, George Walsh, and of course, moving there meant that, okay, Bar, you are now off the air because that's just how it was done. The program director at HAS had an office, had a secretary. I'd never had a secretary before. I was like, what the heck am I going to do with a secretary? you guys may remember Vicki Berger, who was a receptionist, and George Walsh said, you have to bear in mind the era in which he said this, okay, and it's the gal of your choice. You know, you probably wouldn't use that language today, or you'd be burned someplace. But,
right.
But after a couple of weeks, I wondered, how on earth I'd ever gotten along without a secretary. Of course, now that'd be an admin assistant. But that was great. Then we started in, and you guys were such a major part of all of that.
What was it like when you came there? What was the station doing, and what were your expectations? Did you have a master plan? You said, we got to do this, we got to do that. What was it like when you got there?
And what was the charge they gave you?
Wayne, it said, go find Wayne.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, and go find JDM, and you'll be fine. And actually, that's true. It was pretty obvious what needed to happen. I mean, the formatics were quite old. It was one of the wonderful, wonderful old heritage stations. And we've all read about the early WHAS days, and it's a leadership role radio in radio pioneering, probably capped with the flood coverage of 37 in those days. I mean, it was truly an important radio history. But like a lot of the old properties, it had become rather stale, very top-heavy. And the format that was implemented basically was a, not quite a carbon copy, but the formatics were very similar to what I had been doing, and I made an assumption based on that, that this is what the guys really wanted. So that's what we did. I think the biggest initial challenge, because the structure was really ingrained, we had people who had done things a certain way for a long time, and nothing wrong with that. I mean, it had worked so well, but it didn't need to be changed. And the I think the biggest change initially was the introduction of a jock combo situation. Everything prior to that time was IBEW. The guys, you know, ran the board for the people. They
that's,
were producers.
That's the engineers union, right?
And yes, right. And in fact, in the first month I was there, I had IBEW filed 3 complaints against me. But in time that all worked out well, because I think he realized I was not there in any kind of a vendetta situation.
Well, wasn't radio sort of a, not a stepchild, but television was the kind of driving the thing there, and didn't staff go back and forth between radio and television a lot at that time?
Yeah, they did quite a bit. Ray Shelton did did a lot of stuff on television. I think he had a show or something in the afternoon. And yes, there was a lot of that. And of course, the news department was totally integrated. And fortunately, I was able to get that changed. And the timing was rather spectacular, because we just 9 months before that fateful day in '74, the tornado, we had formed our own independent radio news department focused only on radio. Glenn Baston was director.
Mm-hmm.
And there was almost like we'd been prepping for the big event in that sense. But I don't know. I was trying to think, Jack, the biggest problems were really orienting the station into a world that was kind of unusual for the people who were on the broadcast side in those days. And there were some rough spots, because we did have to make some changes. We did so gradually, but they were things that needed to be done. And fortunately, we were blessed with an ownership that really did give a damn, pardon my French, about the people who worked there. So no one was hurt in that situation, at least that I was ever aware of. That was kind of a paternalistic view that ownership had with the Binghams, and of course, starting with a good giant way, way back when. But I think the biggest memory I have is really just all of the, and I don't mean to be pandering in saying this. I have no need to do so. It is the truth. It's just the terrific guys who actually made it happen. I mean,
now was Wayne your first sort of hire to put in that morning show and get that rolling along with the news department? How did you come upon Wayne Perkey?
I was trying to remember that last night, and Wayne, you're going to have to tell me. We found you someplace.
I was working in Mobile, Alabama, doing television, and Bob Morse had been my news director, and Bob had come to be the new news director at WHAS, Inc. He and you arrived about the same time, as I recall.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was telling these guys that one day you walked into Bob's office and said, I know there was a guy you worked with in Mobile. I have his tape and resume somewhere, and I cannot find it. And Bob called me and said, Wayne, you call Hugh Barr right now. And I did.
I love it.
So I remember that I came to interview with you in August, the summer of '69. I parked my car beside the building and came inside thinking I'd be there an hour. if I was lucky, you know, and you guys really liked me, and I'd be on my way. And we spent the day together. You and Jim Topmiller took me to lunch. Oh, gosh, the place is not any longer there on 4th Avenue.
It was one of the
upscale places. We made, anyway, at the end of the day, when you turned me loose, they towed my car. Not an auspicious beginning. And that was in July, and I didn't come to work for you until November. Remember, because you had lots of challenges working through how everything was going to function.
Oh, we had so many things. You know, we had a long, long morning show in the morning. And in those days when we did Diary, we had no basic information. We could get our hands on the raw data of diaries, and it was pretty clear that in Louisville, 20% of all of the radio listening began before 5:30 in the morning. And, you know, nothing against Barney, who was such a wonderful guy and became such an integral part of the revised programming.
That's Barney Arnold, the news farm director.
Right, right. And we were just, I mean, we were basically programming to a world that had changed and was not quite the same as it had been when they initiated that initial formatting. But, well, you know, I always liked Bob Morris, and now my esteem has gone up even more. So now that we put that together, that's great. That's a great story.
It was a good choice because Wayne was on the air there mornings for over 30 years. That was a good choice.
So the funny part about this is I thought that we reached an understanding before I left your office. And I got in my car, and we got back to Mobile, and then you didn't call. And you didn't call. And you didn't call.
You're kidding.
No, so it was my first day at WHAS was November 10.
Wow. Well, that's, shame on me. My retroactive apologies. That's terrible. I hope I have learned.
Do you recall what attracted what Wayne had that you were looking for to be sort of the kingpin of that new WHAS? Do you recall anything about that?
I don't think you hired me to be the morning guy, did you? That kind of developed.
I think that did develop, and I
was Jerry David did that.
Was Jerry David doing mornings? Oh,
yeah. Jerry David followed Jim Walton when Jim moved up to the Crusade Department.
So Jerry was already there.
Yes, I was there.
Okay.
I thought, sure, this guy, big tall guy coming in with a beard and I don't know what all. I thought, oh, I'm out of here. I am gone.
We just had some building blocks to go through. I think that the major changes happened to, well, I always found... I don't know. I fell upon a term once. Some guy used the phrase "the power of responsive psychology," and I think that really does kind of fit. I mean, the key we were after. I mean, the term, the image slogan, the cuddly giant, kind of wrapped it all together, basically. But we were trying to find talent to fit the need. We set up some appropriate expectations, build a couple of yardsticks with, I hope, some respectful feedback from me, and then it's basically get the heck out of the way. You know, people gravitate to people they like, and I think the underpinning of the fun we had in those years is that we enjoyed a group that was entertaining. You guys were always engaging, I mean, sometimes challenging, but I think it was a very human element on the air that somebody on the other side, somebody on the listening side, just enjoyed being around.
It was kind of remarkable the way everything developed. When I went on mornings and Jerry took over 9 to noon, Jerry, didn't you have a caller, a lady who was, who would call you every... now and then was kind of fun. And then Jeff Douglas joined us when Van Vance became a sports guy at full time.
Right.
You brought Jeff in.
I think, I think you're referring, I think the lady was the lady that called Jeffy.
Yeah, Charlie, yes. Charlie was her name, yeah, Charlie.
Yes. Charlie, yes. Yeah. And
I was married. I had no women calling me on the radio.
No. You know, I've thought about the fact that we had no female jocks on the air. I mean, we, in a way, we did have some female representation because of Phyllis Knight.
Right.
But it was really tough. I know the funnel was just male-oriented. The people coming up that were interested in the biz were male, and gradually that changed, of course. And I think, without criticizing the male members on this phone call, I think getting the female orientation into broadcast really was a welcome and very productive kind of thing to happen. We saw it first, of course, in sales, and in sales forever, they were, it was a male-oriented kind of environment. And of course, now I think in almost every broadcast situation, the vast majority of sales execs are female. But
you know, that brings to mind another thing. You did not only just on the air stuff, but really you had a job to do with community acceptance too, because WHAS was not first on people's minds then. You were developing a good product, but you had to also to develop a campaign to overcome that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, the you know, once we have the people on the air that were demonstrating a lot of humor and empathy and interest in the community, it was really, the next thing was really to try to find marketing. And of course, WHAS at that point in the demos that we really wanted was almost a non-entity, sadly. They, I mean, we owned everybody in the 50-plus category.
And but, all the UK fans.
And they, yes, fortunately we had...
we had Kaywood Ledford.
I'm sorry?
We had Kaywood Ledford and UK basketball.
That's it, you know, and that's what really bled into the younger demos. And that, but anyway, the I mean, we started promoting, we promoted stuff, and we began making some gradual inroads. The thing that really did it actually was the tornado, for which I really do think we were uniquely prepared for that. We broadcast commercial-free for 3 days, I remember, something that most ownerships, management teams would never allow in today's world. But again, that was part of the Bingham philosophy. It was really the community service. And gradually we worked back into it. But you guys were just really spectacular, and that deserves so much credit. I mean, it was a fly-by-wire deal, opened the phone lines, took what was happening, tried to coordinate things as best we could. We really did indeed become the voice of the community. And incidentally, or maybe not so incidentally, the tornado occurred during the 2 week Arbitron sweep.
We always wondered how you pulled that off. You know?
Well, in those days, as you guys probably don't remember, but the it was 2 weeks in the spring and 2 weeks in the fall, and that was it.
Yeah,
and this happened during the two-week Arbitron sweep. It catapulted us, pardon me, into basically the commanding position that the station retained forever, thanks to you guys, because you're the guys that kept it going. But I think, you know, the market responded. There was a genuine service orientation going on there, and they basically just rediscovered the station.
You know, I remember, Hugh, the first time, actually, you would call us into your office regularly and talk about what was going on with the numbers when the book came in. And I remember the first time you said to me, no, come over on my side of the desk and let me show you these numbers over my shoulder. And I said, Hugh, that's the first time you've ever let me look at the book. And you leaned back in your chair and roared with laughter and said, I couldn't show you before. It would have broken your heart.
Well, you know, we were all just working against the situation, trying to make things better. We had, in my judgment, a spectacular product. We just had trouble corralling people to recognize it. But, you know, the app followed that. Dick Gilbert was named, you know, Nixon named the pilot of the year.
Now, tell us how Dick Gilbert, did you discover Dick Gilbert? How did that come? How did that happen?
You know, that was...
He was a traffic copter reporter.
Skywatch 84, right?
Yes.
I think one of the elements I look back with some enduring surprise is how lucky I have been in so many ways through all these years in my career. It had become rather apparent, just anybody who had to drive in around Louisville, the traffic is really becoming a major deal, and nobody's doing anything with it. I mean, they were trying, and they had some smaller efforts, but nobody's really doing anything. And this is no joke, about a week after I initiated some discussions internally about something we really needed to think about, this guy, Dick Gilbert, appeared at the radio station. And he had been working in New York City, doing traffic up there for, I think, WCBS.
He was a Louisville boy, wasn't he? Wasn't he from Louisville or something?
Yes. He has, if I'm remembering correctly, and if I'm not, I apologize, through the ether to Dick. He had lost his wife, had a daughter, wanted to raise his daughter in Louisville. And that was the background, which was rather sad from his standpoint, rather fortuitous from ours. And that's how we hooked up. And then there was trying to persuade Barry Jr. that this was something we really needed to do. And, of course, there was a big number attached to it. But again, good for him. He said, you know, I think you're right, and we did it. So he joined us and then became such an integral part of the whole service team.
What were your feelings that day in 1974 when the tornado came through? That obviously changed everything, but what were your feelings? Do you remember your feelings that day and everything going through your mind? Do you recall any of that?
I really do, Jack. I mean, that's just... anybody who went through that, and of course you relived it for years after that, every time there was a serious storm that came through because you just relived the event. Yeah, it started gradually. I mean, some storm warnings, it really got tipped going when south of us, and I've forgotten the name of the town.
Brandenburg,
thank you. Where a tornado had actually touched down, and then, let's see, Byron, I think,
Byron Crawford.
Yeah, I think Brian and Glenn began doing talking with the guy, the head meteorologist, about what was happening. And, you know, the storm came through so quickly that pretty soon the whole program just converted to following the storm. But particularly after they had viewed the touchdowns, and as you guys may remember, Dick spied a touchdown while he was giving a broadcast and so graphically described as he followed this tornado. Incidentally, he had been ordered by the tower to come down. He declined to do so at probably some peril to his future flying, but it all turned out to be okay. But, you know, he followed that. He forecast where things were headed. And you know, the station was credited with saving many, many lives, and I'm sure, given what could have been. I'm sure that's correct. That's very correct. But I remember that with the exception of the air staff, everybody else was huddled in the basement. Barry was down there, and we'd dash up every once in a while, and of course people were listening to the radio and hearing what was going on. And then basically we were just trying to organize people so that we could keep what we had initiated on the air, just keep going, and everybody did. I mean, it was just a wonderful, wonderful exhibit of everyone working together for a common cause. That sounds a little untruth, I suppose, but it was very true. I mean, it's just terrific guys who really cranked at it, and everybody's first concern was, I think, very honest and very heartfelt. Community had been through a lot going on. How can we help? How can we be there? And that was, I think, indicative of the general spirit of the philosophy of the radio station, whether it was injecting humor or service. I think that was kind of a hallmark that made that particular group of people in those few years really stand out in the community, and certainly stand out in my mind.
Certainly gave a stamp to your philosophy of finding good people, and that you put a lot of thought into that, finding the right people in the right slot and having good chemistry. Everybody worked together, including, as I recall, not just on the air staff, but the sales department was kind of involved in that, the news department, all those meshed. And that was very unusual for a radio station, especially a radio station that size. There didn't seem to be territories. I mean, we obviously had our turf, but everybody worked together for a common cause, and you were, you were the wizard behind the curtain there, pulling all those strings.
Well, you're nice to say that. I think we did share a philosophy. I think one of the things, when you look for, and people will ask me, what do you look for in people? And I think that's pretty simple. All you guys have to do is look around. And what was evident to me is undoubtedly evident to you. I mean, you have real people doing it. Yes, I mean, there's a certain technology involved, and you have to be skilled in what you're doing. And a layer of talent doesn't hurt. But, that basically comes from what's cooking inside the individual. I think that's the thing that always drew me to you guys, because it really... it was a very unique mix. It truly was. And I don't want to sound like sour grapes, because it's not, but I think, people look at WHAS and they talk about the golden age radio. And I think, in fact, there was, in those early pioneer days, I mean, some incredible things that people did. They took enormous risks. They put together something that was really unique. And in those early days when there was so much experimentation and working, that kind of gets the focus. But I think in the age that we were all together there, we had kind of our own golden age that I've never felt really received the recognition that it should. I mean, we turned a corner. We rebuilt a wonderful old station into a really a huge competitive powerhouse. I think based on the original tenets of the Good Judge, but that station's survival meant really contemporizing its approach. We maintained a service orientation, but it was wrapped inside a modern vehicle. But it was genuinely fun to listen to. And I think probably because of that, doesn't get some of the credit that it deserved. And I'm not trying to take that credit for me. I don't mean that at all. But I think it's really hard. We deviated from the old stately real green churches and classrooms in their every backwood cabin. That was kind of a preamble of the early Bingham days. And we got a lot of credit, but I think historians like serious, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a different lens. Kind of like, I remember hearing a conversation with Jack Lemmon once. You know, and he was nominated as best actor, I don't know, about a bazillion times. But he said that people who have fun or convey fun just aren't taken seriously. I think he did go ahead and win an Oscar. You guys will know better than I. But I think there was a little bit of that. The early years where they crank it up into the industry. But the foundation that you guys were so instrumental in building, you know, maintained that station for a long, long time. And in a very, very dominant position that really was the envy of a lot of people in our industry.
Well, it truly became the cuddly giant. Did you come up with that term? Who came up with the term the cuddly giant? And I guess the tornado was sort of the turning point for that to really come into existence and enjoy several years of that. Who came up with that term?
Well, you know, I'll take the blessings or the or the curses. But that was really pretty simple, Jack. We really needed some imaging, something that would really stick, that would kind of personify the whole ball of wax of what we were. We had, on the one side, we were this caring kind of paternal entity in the marketplace. And our first concern was, In fact, I was trying to remember some of the early marketing on the air that we used that had to do with the news. Something that your desire to know comes first from Kentucky and his newsleader, something like that. Anyway, but the Cuddly Giant just seemed to wrap in the friendly, warm, encompassing nature of the personality of the radio station. It was really somebody fun and friendly to be with, much like you'd like to have this guy for your next door neighbor. And I claim no great credit for it. I did like it, frankly, and found this guy, Brother John. You guys may remember him. They had fabulous pipes out of New York City, who did the image liners for us. Using that term, the cuddly giant, you're within the giant reach of the cuddly giant. I'm trying to remember some of those. You guys will remember better than I. But it just encompassed kind of the approach of the radio station and what it really represented and what it could mean to the community, Jack. That's about it.
Well, Hugh, you started that journey in 1969, and you were at the. When did you leave? What year did you leave the station?
I left in, I'm going to say 76 or 77, it may have been 77.
Yeah, I was there through middle of 76 and you were still there. But my point of that was, and we'll talk more about what you did after that, but my point of that was you got it up and running, but you had to do a little tweaking along the way too. I remember, you know, you had to add some people. I remember you may want to talk about Jeff Douglas for just a moment. Jeff was the afternoon guy and we had a very... somber afternoon one time when Jeff didn't show up.
That was the that undoubtedly is the saddest memory from that time was Jeff's death and the circumstances that were really tough. And he was just a nice, a great addition to what we needed in the afternoon. Somebody really friendly that could take people home and would be fun to drive with and. Had a great feel. He was another guy that just had some unique personality traits, just quirky enough, but fun and legit. And of course, had a background in broadcast. But that was, that was good. That was a very sad time when we lost Jeffy. And of course, then we brought in Gary.
Yeah, I want to talk about Gary Burbank. How did that happen? Because that was a big departure, come from a rock jock who had been at Wacky there and had gone to a station in Detroit and was known as kind of a wild character. And here we're an adult radio station. How did you make that decision? And how did that come about?
And well, I knew I was going to have an interesting discussion with the management team there, Barry and Cy. but it just made sense. I had heard that Gary, and he had made quite a name for himself up there. And I used to love the way he would talk. He'd say, when he would do one of his voices, and he said, "This is Gary Burbank coming to you from my mouth," which that was a panic. But he was interested in coming down. We'd had some discussions, obviously not before Jeffy's death, but afterwards. His wife was from Louisville, and I forgot whether it was just a flyer. Somehow we connected.
Jeffy called me. When Jeffy died, Gary called me. He was in Windsor and said, "Wayne, do you think they would even consider talking to me?" And that's when I burst into your office and said, "Hugh, here's the guy. He reports to you."
Well, listen, we need to send you roses or something, because we began communicating, and the first image was, wow, wacky and a crazy guy, and we were kind of, and of course, at this point, it was convincing Barry and Cy that we had really turned that corner. We're not flaky. We're responsible, but we like to have fun. And here's a guy that would, in my judgment, really pick up the pieces in a critical time period. And the rest then is, I guess, commercial history. And I have forgotten that, Wayne. Again, my apologies. I need to brush some heavy credit brush across you for that as well, and for your good memory. Thank you. I got it. One of the big kicks with Gary. Gary had never, his first day on the air, I do remember that, was a panic, because he had never met a clock time.
Never met a clock he liked.
He'd never met a clock deadline like for a newscast, and the poor guy, he was scared to death. You've got the music, you got the format bits, but how do you make it work? But he hit it right on. I do remember he came in and we had a long talk about how can I stretch, how can I contract, what do I have to do in order to, to hit the time. But that was great. And of course the derbies were all wonderful. And we had such a wonderful time, and you guys have all been involved in that. And Wayne, you kicked off the early morning, always back in the paddock, and those were just wonderful times. I remember, Vicki Berger's dad was a trainer, and Wayne, I'm sure you remember that. But she was good enough to arrange for my youngest daughter to visit the stalls on Derby morning. And it's one of her fondest memories, one of mine as well. I mean, she actually petted Secretariat and, wow, and then had her picture distributed nationwide by Associated Press. You remember Nola Hotsey, the horse that always came in second. And that horse decided to snack on a little jacket she was wearing, and the photographer just happened to be there and got it. that was great. But the engineering stuff, when I think of problems we overcame.
You changed equipment and everything too, didn't you? From turntables to everything else.
Oh, yeah. Everything became combo and home. No. Oh, man. A little secret between the chief engineer and myself, and I'm fighting my memory for the name of the engineer. Very nice guy. What the heck was his name? I'm sorry. Never mind. Anyway, what shows you how much the initial antagonism had turned into cooperation. I want to do
Harold DeArmond. Was it Harold DeArmond?
No, predating.
Okay. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Anyway, I wanted to install a dynamic equalizer into the sound. And this is I don't know what they call it now. That's what it's called then. I'd always been a fan of the ballistics of sound. And to give us a little mid-range edge, we put in this dynamic equalizer and added just an edge of reverb. And he and I never disclosed it to anyone. Not even Ed Shadburn was aware that that thing was cranking along. I have no idea how long it remained after I left. I was always worried that somebody would catch on to that. But he did give us a little leg. Once in a while, I could hear when we were doing sound checks that were board-oriented instead of off the air. And I swear I could detect a little. I was just always scared to death somebody was going to follow about that, and I was going to get another protest from IBEW or whatever. But, those were great.
Well, you also, you know, talking of the production part, you also introduced another element there, and that was a production director. Up to that point, the engineers had put things together, but didn't you actually carve out a production director, Jim Ferguson, John Polk, in that tradition?
Yes, actually, I think the first production director we had by name was,
Jim Ferguson, was it?
Yes, Jim Ferguson.
Right. Thank you so much.
Yes. I mean, we just needed the, you know, sales was cranking, and in the earlier days, I mean, there was a copy book, and everybody read the copy, and there was very little recording, and the dynamics of the radio station required effects and a little energy and what's going on, so we taped everything. that began, a production department, because the spots needed to match the energy of the rest of the station. And in one theme that we tried to keep going, even through the commercials, whether it was music or effects or something, it never stopped. It was just kind of a forward dynamic of the radio station. And then when we would stop down and somebody would do an ad-lib spot, I mean, that was really a big deal, and those were thought through very carefully. We limited the number of those, but they were always incredibly effective because you guys were really good at doing what you did, and so those things really stood out. But yes, we had to initiate the whole production outfit. I remember the first automobile we had for the news department, and I dented the fender in it. Always embarrassing.
You know, you remember one of the most fun promotions we did was when Shillitoes came to the brand new Oxmoor Center. And I think Tanini might have been, I've forgotten, where maybe Jerry Solomon was the salesman who was handling the account. But all the personalities were invited to come out to Shillitoes and look at all the stuff they had for sale, and then simply make up commercials about them.
You know, I had forgotten that. That's right. That would have been. I can't remember what year that would have been. But
71, maybe.
Yeah, there would be very much like, it was just kind of what the radio station did. I mean, they were just, I would have no idea whose idea that was. Probably yours, Wayne. No.
I believe Ed Tanini was the one who brought us the idea, but I'm not sure. I also remember the first Jeffy's birthday party we staged, and that it was either in the mall or Oxmoor. Jeffy dressed up in a bunny rabbit suit. And all the personalities came, and nobody came.
Oh.
Remember, Jerry?
There was a great, you know, in fact, I ran across a 2 days ago, I was doing a little cleaning. I have a storage unit I hadn't addressed for 100 years of stuff that has followed me forever. And I was going through an old box, and I found an old box of broadcast material, and in it was a sheet of just one sheeter of all the promotion activities that JDM and Jeffy and Wayne and everybody were involved in the community, along with Milton. And Jack, you, in fact, you were in there on a couple of items. And it covered, there was a puff piece, I guess, that we did for sales department. I'll probably send it over to the paper as well. That identified all the individuals and the activities that were involved in each month. And I ran across one page, it was a phenomenal, just a phenomenal number of events and public appearances that you guys were involved in doing, either emceeing or talking to a class or whatever it may have been. It was always something out in front of the public, talking to a club or maybe a service organization. A couple of schools I know were in there. And that was just one sheet that I happened to hang on to it. I scanned that last night and sent it over to Ed Shadburn. And I'd be glad to scan and send it to you guys as well.
That'd be great.
Running short on time last night. But I think you would get an honest kick out of really how incredibly busy you guys were. I mean, you were in front of that community constantly, just constantly.
Really was the cuddly giant then, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really was.
Hugh, this is Jerry David. I know they tied me in a closet and wouldn't let me out, but I'm still here. I want to go back a minute to the people you hired and the group that we got together. And you were remarkable in being able to choose the right people, I think. But more importantly, in my opinion, is that you did so many of these events for us. We would do a big movie would come out, and it was going to be shown. And we would
First Godfather.
The Godfather.
We
always remember that.
Suits.
Yes. But you had us on each one of our shows. We would play some kind of a game to get a winner, and it'd be a couple, you know. And then we would go with our wives in those days, and we'd all go. Well, that was a That played a big role in why we got along, I think. And we really appreciated each one of us as being talented, but also we found ourselves to be friends. And that meant so much to our growth, I think. Yep. But you were great about getting our names out there and the station out there. When I came, before you were here, I came from a 50, let's see, a daytimer radio station in Dayton, Ohio.
Now, okay.
And it was a good station. Just great people there. But we didn't know each other. And that was just a small group, you know. But when I came to Louisville, and before you, I didn't know anybody there. You know, not only did you have to try to remember the names of your co-workers as far as being on the air, but you had all the engineers that you had to remember. But when you came, you had this idea of promotions where we were together, whether it be a play or a football tickets or basketball tickets or movies or whatever. And I think it really played a big role in how we all worked together and how we were all proud of where we worked. And I think the people that we met were pretty excited about it all and got to meet all of us and other people. So I think that was just incredible what you did there.
Well, bless your heart for saying that. I always felt that there was a wonderful family environment. you know, the somebody I met as a management guru once said, you've got to be objective, you've got to be flexible, you've got to be compatible. And you guys were all that. And I mean, and really heavy on the compatible side, which is really what was so endearing to the audience. Because I think they sense those things. That when it is genuine, I mean, there's just a totally different reaction to what they're hearing out of the speaker. And you guys were so great that way. And yeah, there was just a very strong family approach. And the fact that you guys were compatible, and I remember telling somebody years later that, well, you know, for instance, when when Gary came down, pardon me, the you know, one of the things I felt was really important was the chemistry and the feedback from you guys. And you remember we turned him loose with you guys for a couple of hours all by your lonelies in a production studio so you could get acquainted and I could get your feedback. And I think that was an outgrowth of the fact that there were no walls between you guys. I mean, it was just like one big family, and that lived in the same house. The house just happened to be the radio station.
I want to piggyback on that and what Jerry said. When I came up to interview, we had talked on the phone. I came to interview with you, and my wife came with me. And at the end of the day, we wound up at dinner at Louisville Downs with Wayne and Jane Ann and Jerry and Kay.
Did it snow that night?
I don't remember that, but the thing that impressed us was how close they were. Milton and his wife were there, and I think you and Maureen may have been there, but it impressed us that this was a group that they were all got along. They liked each other. That was nice.
Ken Schultz was part of that team, too, and he and his wife had stopped at my house and ridden out with us because he's brand new in town. And it snowed. Do you remember? We had a heck of a snowfall that night, and his car got stuck in my driveway, and he couldn't get out.
Oh, my gosh.
Left two big ruts.
Yeah, the snow was kind of crazy. We had, you know, the one year when the river froze over, I mean, it sounds like the river froze over. Well, it did.
It did. It did. Yeah.
Yeah. And
Gary invented the snow sharks. Were you still here?
The snow, I love the name, though.
He talks about that on another interview, Gary invented snow sharks. We'll talk about that again. Well, let me talk, switch gears just a minute. You mentioned Ed Shadburn's name a few minutes ago. Ed was the general manager. He had high praise for you. In fact, when I interviewed him, he said, thank God Hugh Barr was there. He said,
no.
But was he the only GM while in your tenure there? Did Ed leave and somebody else come in? I was trying to remember the GMs while you were there.
Yeah, there was Sholas, and then there was Ed. And then there was Fred.
Fred Osler, was Fred in there?
Fred Osler came after, yes. I worked with Fred, I think for less than a year, actually. I'd really never been a GM, although they didn't call it a GM at HAS, until Ed took leave of his good senses and made me a manager. Totally blew his reputation by doing that.
I think he did very well.
I really enjoyed it. Ed and I thought it worked extremely well together. He understood very, very well what we were doing. He had a lot of respect for the guys on the air. A really good guy. I was kind of hoping he might be on board with this conversation today. I've always had a real fondness for Ed. He's a
He has family in town today, or he would have been here. He wanted to come, but he has family in town. He couldn't be here.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Well, let me ask you this. You left WHAS, we think, around, what, 1978, 77, 78.
Right.
But leading up to that, now, I wasn't aware of your background before you had come. You had not had this kind of experience at other radio stations, I don't think, had you? Had you kind of, was this a master plan in the back of your mind developing this, or were you kind of making it up as you go along? Had you had this kind of success at a previous radio station? You were a pretty young guy.
I think in Louisville I had the chance to do to paint a prettier picture there than I had been able to do earlier. I mean, both in Casper and in Ogden, I was program director, and you know, the format was my format, and but had never had the ability, as I did in Louisville, to build everything from the ground up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when you have an opportunity like that, which is pretty rare, it made things, you know, despite the frustrations that come along with doing something like that, it was a wonderful opportunity. And the concept of just building a radio station, yeah, it was like your good buddy next door that you'd rely on when things are tough, and that you'd enjoy watching the ball game with on the weekend. It's always been endearing to me. That's always been my favorite kind of broadcasting. I think it's the most effective kind. It does get the highest response level from people, like just in terms of emotional attachment. And we had it all there. I think we had a great package.
And you also were able to gather people who really loved radio and loved working. I remember the first state fair, Kentucky State Fair, after I came aboard, 1970. Maureen and I, your wife and I, were the two people manning the booth at the state fair. Giving away a giant Zenith color TV, as I recall. We had simply a curtain and a table and pencils to sign people up.
Oh yeah, I mean we made a little progress in the state fair, as you remember. We suspended a car, I think, out there once, and we had the big giant posters, the drawings, the heads of you guys that we used promotionally. I always liked those. I always wished I had some copies of those.
One of my favorite memories of that was, We had shopping bags with our caricature on them, and one had, "I spend my mornings with Jerry David Malloy," and I'll never forget, I saw a little nun carrying one around, and a lady who was very, very pregnant carrying one of those around.
What happened off the air, you know.
Well, Hugh, you did some marvelous, marvelous things here. I've conducted many of these interviews, and in most every one of them, your name comes up, and it gets credit for, you know, taking WHAS from its previous golden days into that golden era. You left here to go to Syracuse, is that right?
Actually, I joined Golden West and the Gene Autry up in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
And they had acquired the properties up there, didn't have anybody to run them, and really liked what we were doing. That's it. The Golden West, which was the name of their company, big gun personality stations on the West Coast, San Francisco, L.A., had acquired the property in Chicago, and decided I would be the guy to go up there. And I'm glad I did. It was not a happy experience, frankly. Before too long, I could kind of read the tea leaves. The guy that I had built a strong relationship with was gone. He called me one morning and said, "Hugh, the board has met, and I'm no longer with the company." And pretty soon I was reporting to a guy who ran their television side of things, who had never been in radio. Mm. And within a period of a few months, we were all gone, all of the radio guys replaced with his team. And that was his prerogative. It was not a happy time from that standpoint personally, but I've never held any grudge. I mean, it was kind of what he wanted to do. But fortunately, that got me over to Syracuse, and which was another situation, somewhat analogous to the WHAS situation, another wonderful old-line radio station that had been a pioneer of sorts that was just had lagged behind the time clock and needed contemporizing. And I had a lot of fun up there, just really enjoyed it. When I was up there, the property that was owned by Newhouse, which is, you know, owns newspapers and magazines, Condé Nast is one of their outfits. And it was fun, but the another outfit bought those properties when Newhouse was worried about the FCC and concentration of media, and they sold their radio properties. We had three little markets. I was running those, and then my boss for many, many years had a little company. He had expanded the company, bought the properties in Syracuse, then became New City Communications, and I was in Syracuse running those properties up there for 8 or 9 years. And we acquired properties in San Antonio and had nobody to run them. And I was doing one of those every other week routines up and back. And as I mentioned at the head end of this, I'd get up in the morning and I'd see blue sky and San Antonio, and I'd get up in Syracuse and it'd be ice cold and blowing and cold. And I brought Maureen down for several long weekends, and that was pretty much it. I said, no, I'll do those down there. I'll just come down and take care of those, and we'll elevate somebody inside. Fortunately, had really good people to do that. And that was it. You know, I came down here and had been a group VP with New City and retained that position with Cox. And it turned out it was really interesting. Bob Neal, who is the at that point the president of in running the Cox radio side, is a guy I had hired as a program director in Syracuse. And he had moved within the company down to an Atlanta property, at that point I was still a New City property, and he moved across the street to Cox, and then Cox turned around and bought New City. It was all a very incestuous kind of relationship, but it was great, and I've remained here by choice since then, and been a retired in 99. I can hardly believe it. I mean, it's almost 15 years ago now. But I had a wonderful ride, and frankly, in retrospect, in looking back at the real highlights, and I think we do kind of in our reminiscing moments, we look back at stuff that were things that were really important to us. And in my tenure there at WHAS was without a doubt the most exciting and just thoroughly rewarding from a creative standpoint. It was just wonderful being with a bunch of terrific guys who made it happen.
Well, you got to see your ideas put into action and proven correct. That's very satisfying.
Well, it was terrific. I enjoyed it, you guys, and I have always been indebted to that time. I know it was important to Maureen as well, and she loved those days very, very much, and certainly respected all of you guys. You know, a lot of stories that you guys have shared, and you'll probably continue to share about those days. I mean, we hit the high points, and we had some low points, and we've discussed that. The sadness surrounding Jeffy's death, it certainly hits that. A lot of wonderful, wonderful high points, and just some successes and personal achievements. I think that we all share, and I really mean that in the legit form of the word. I mean, we all shared it. It was something we all did together. I think that's one thing that made it so great.
It was a great time, and we thank you for that. Thank you for taking the time here today, And it, with apologies to the group who paid tribute to you on YouTube, we're going to have the cuddly giant quartet minus one close this with a little tribute to you.
We're glad we got to know you.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys.
Thank you.
I have enjoyed this. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. You guys are important in my life, and thank you again so much. And Jack, you take care, and I guess you'll be, send me the release, and we'll get that back to you.
You'll be the first to know.
No, okay. you have to come here and get it.
Ah, there we go. That's better. I'm going to turn the recorder off, but hang on just a minute here.
Yeah.